03-0561-CR, State v. James Moran. And we'll first hear from Colleen Ball. Let me just ask a question. Do we have summaries of this case available? Does everybody here have an available summary? Good. All right. Attorney Colleen Ball. Let me, when you start, so I don't forget, Ms. Ball, Attorney Ball, has been appointed by this court to represent the defendant in this appeal. She is counsel and has appeared in many appellate cases and is appearing pro bono, that is, on behalf of the public without compensation in preparation and representation here today, and we appreciate you doing that, Ms. Ball. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Colleen Ball and I'm appearing on behalf of the petitioner, James Moran. During the past 10 years, DNA technology has emerged as a force in the criminal justice system. The testing is now so sophisticated that we can know conclusively whether DNA from one person matches DNA evidence left at a crime scene. In 2001, the Wisconsin legislature, like many states around the country, enacted a statute designed to assist convicted criminals in accessing DNA evidence in order to correct a miscarriage of justice. And that's what Section 97407 is all about. It is a legislative decision that, with respect to DNA evidence, traditional avenues of post-conviction relief are not good enough. It is, as we shall see, a statute that dismantles rather than erects barriers to post-conviction DNA testing. Now, the statute envisions two phases of proceedings. In the first one, the petitioner or the movant asks the court to order either access to DNA evidence or testing of DNA evidence. And in the second stage, the court decides, based on those test results, whether to order any relief. This case is only about the first stage of proceedings. The only thing that James Moran is here asking the court for is to give him either access to the evidence or to order testing. He is not here asking for a new trial, a new sentence, or any other form of ultimate relief.
Well, one of the issues would be whether or not the same standard is used for new trial as for getting the evidence in discovery, because the concept of reasonable probability appears in both. Isn't that right?
That's correct. It could be relevant, ultimately, when you get to the second stage, but we can't decide that now because we don't know what the DNA test results are going to show.
So they may show nothing, and then you just have to stop. The defendant would just cease.
That's correct. Now, to help the court understand why James Moran is entitled to the testing he seeks right now and access to the evidence, I'd like to address three points. The first one is the significance that the state itself attached to the blood evidence at trial. The second is some key provisions of the statute and how they apply to this case. And the third is why the court should have no qualms about ordering testing in this case. And just Chief Justice Abrahamson, before I proceed, I am going to read an excerpt from the district attorney's closing argument, and I also would like to highlight a couple of provisions that were not set out fully in the briefs, and I brought copies of those with me if it will help the members of the court follow along.
Before you get there, and this is a basic question of the standard you're using, and the state is talking about an outcome determinative standard. In other words, if the evidence would change the outcome, are you talking about something different? I'm talking about a case like the O'Brien case.
Mr. Moran's position is that the test, reasonable probability of a different outcome, is an undermined confidence test as opposed to an outcome determinative test. And O'Brien is relevant, potentially. If you look at the language of the O'Brien decision, there is a point in the case where the court says a reasonable probability is a probability sufficient to undermine outcome. And then the court cites Strickland and Bagley two cases that are well accepted for the proposition that they are an undermined confidence test.
Yeah, but O'Brien has other language that would indicate that it's outcome determinative.
It does.
Might.
Possibly. I mean, it's ambiguous, I would say.
So O'Brien decided before the change in statute?
Yes, it was. And that's, I guess the question is whether you want me to go there right now or
let's do the significance of the blood.
All right.
That's what you told us.
Would it be possible for me to give these materials to the...
Mr. O'Brien, do you have any objection? They're from the record.
Sorry, what are the materials?
One of it is a one-and-a-half-page excerpt of a transcript from the record, and the other is just a copy of the statute to make sure that the members of the court have it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Marshall would do that.
Thank you very much. Turning first to the blood evidence, what evidence are we talking about? First of all, three samples of blood evidence taken from Corey Pinchard's apartment. James Moran would like DNA testing of that. And secondly, the three blood standards drawn from James, Jake, and Corey, and he wants access to those standards so that he can perform independent tests on blood evidence that was retrieved from just outside Corey Pinchard's door. Now, there is really a simple way to slice through the record in this case. The members of the court just need to ask themselves, why does the evidence inside Corey's apartment even exist? Well, it's because 12 days after the incident, the state was on notice that James Moran was asserting that Jake attacked him with a brick and that there was a three-way fight inside Corey's apartment. Consequently, the state considered this evidence so important that it sent a detective and a special investigator back to Corey's apartment 12 days after the crime to collect the evidence. It considered the evidence so important that it took blood samples from James, Jake, and Corey, and on the eve of trial, it sent all of this evidence to the crime lab for testing. It considered the evidence so important that it put three witnesses on trial. They called them the detective, the special investigator, and the crime lab serologist, all of them to testify about this blood evidence. And then the state of Wisconsin discussed the significance of this evidence in its closing argument to the jury. This is what the district attorney said. It's record item number 80, page 75 at the bottom. You heard from Special Investigator Daniel Roman, who, after they had received information that the defendant was claiming now a brick, that they went back on June 29th, he and Detective Jergovic, at Detective Jergovic's direction, to take blood samples from there. And where did they take the samples? Well, they took blood samples in here. They're referring to Corey's apartment. We better see what's going on here because everybody is in here. They took blood samples off the door because there's blood on the door on the outside of it. Is that the defendant's as he is pushing because he's got a bloody head now? We better check and see if that's the defendant's. Here's the brick down here. Is that the brick that was used to smash him in the head? We better check the blood on that. We better pick up the telephone pages, pick up the whole board, and then take it out to the crime lab. We found out one thing that was kind of unique in and of themselves. All of them are ABO type O, and they all break down by an enzyme to differentiate them. And the only blood that is proper for the expert, Daniel Campbell, to offer any opinion, was the blood in the kitchen area, where he said that it was of a similar type of the enzyme type now of Corey Pinchard. The other ones, we can draw no conclusions from. But he went out and got it. He had some new information. Check it out. Do what you can.
Now, wasn't DNA testing available at that time in 98?
I am not sure, Your Honor, but the only thing that the state crime lab did was the blood typing and the PGM subtyping. But we do, for sure now, have the DNA technology to make the determinations that were not possible for them. And the stakes for my client are 60 years of his prison sentence, and the stakes for the state are answers to questions that it deemed vitally important 10 years ago during the trial of James Moran. So that's the blood evidence that I would like to have the court members have firmly in mind as we turn to the interpretation of the statute. So turning...
When are you going to tell us why this is significant to the defendant?
It is significant. Well, as you know, the defendant has asked for both mandatory and or discretionary DNA testing.
Right.
And it is significant because if blood evidence shows James or Jake's blood inside Corey's apartment or just outside Corey's door, then the state of Wisconsin presented false testimony at trial because the only two other witnesses that knew what happened that day said, we were attacked individually when we were defenseless, one inside Corey's apartment, one down the hall away from the brick that that Jake admitted holding in his hand to use as a weapon. Or you can look at this a different way. The state of Wisconsin would not have been able to put on the same theory of the case if this DNA evidence came in. The state would have had to have explained why there were three people's blood inside Corey's apartment. And that version of events is consistent with only one person's testimony, my client's, James Moran's. So the significance of the blood evidence is that it shows the state put on false testimony. It would have lent a great deal of credibility to my client, who really needed it in order to obtain a self-defense instruction as to Corey, in order to prove his self-defense theory as to Jake and Corey, and in order to obtain a reasonable sentence.
Ms. Ball, was this case actually tried on a self-defense theory?
James Moran sought self-defense instructions as to both Jake and Corey. He received them as to Jake. He received nothing as to Corey.
Well, how would this testimony, this evidence, blood evidence, be significant in regard to Corey? Wasn't she stabbed 7 or 9 times?
She was stabbed, I think, approximately 9 times. James's argument with respect to her is that she got in the middle of a brawl, and she was pulling at him as he and Jake were in a fight which Jake provoked. And she got stabbed in the course of all of that.
But both victims here, both victims that were stabbed had life-threatening injuries. And as I recall, Mr. Moran, the only bruises, the only evidence of anything was that he had bruises from another fight on him. So there was nothing. And as the trial judge indicated, the trial judge has said, first, his confession does nothing to support his self-defense theory, and the circuit court found overwhelming evidence that Moran was the instigator of the, and that's borne out by what Justice Crooks just had to say. The only people that were injured here were the two victims that were stabbed by your client.
I don't think the record supports that, Your Honor. First of all, Corey did sustain life-threatening injuries, but Jake didn't, and there isn't any evidence in the record to support that. If you look in the reply brief, Mr. Moran addressed that allegation by the state right there. Secondly, with respect to whether or not Mr. Moran sustained any injuries, there are actually photographs in the record showing injuries, and he testified that he was scratched, hit, and bruised, hit with a brick during the course of this event. And there are photographs attached to the motion for reconsideration that are not consistent with the prior fight he was in, that are consistent with what he testified to at trial here. And finally, the whole issue here is, who was the instigator? And if James is correct that there's blood evidence right outside Corey's door where Jake admits he took a brick to hit my client, then it calls into doubt the whole idea that my client was the instigator. As a matter of fact, Corey says when she saw James come up the stairs, she didn't see a knife in his hand. He did have one in his pocket, but she didn't see it. Only Jake says that he saw it.
Ms. Ball, is there any evidence in the record that is consistent with James' testimony that he was struck with his brick? You talked about the photographs that were attached and that he had some scratches. Is there anything in the record, photos or otherwise, to show that there's something consistent with him actually having been struck with an injury that's consistent with being hit with a brick?
I think the photographs would be the best evidence. I mean, basically we have a credibility battle here between James on the one hand and Jake and Corey on the other.
But, I mean, is there like a bloody head that's part of the photo, something
no,
to show that?
No, not a bloody head, but there are scratches and bruises and things like that.
Counsel, you argue that reasonably probable is an undermine confidence test and not outcome determinative. If the court decides it is an outcome determinative test, can you meet that standard?
Yes, my client still meets the standard for this reason. The prosecution of the case, which is one of the things you can look at under the reasonable probability, it had to be different. If the blood shows James, Jake, and Corey all in the apartment, or James and Jake right outside the door, or Jake's holding a brick, the state couldn't have presented the same case. It would have had to have said, on this night, James pulled a knife in the apartment when there were two people standing there. One watched while the other person was assaulted, or one tried to call 911 while the other was assaulted. Or it would have to say, geez, how they were all three in a brawl or a fight. That's the significance of the evidence. The state could not have put on the same theory of the case because it has the two victims completely separated from each other so that it looks like an intentional attack, an intentional attempted murder on each one of them.
Ms. Ball, you've indicated, and I think the state in its brief has indicated, that you see a distinction between the undermine the confidence in the outcome test and the outcome determinative test. When I look at United States versus Bagley, evidence is material only if there's a reasonable probability that had the evidence been disclosed to the defense, the result of the proceeding would have been different, which sounds like outcome determinative. And then it goes further. A reasonable probability is a probability sufficient to undermine confidence in the outcome. That's the same decision. Isn't the undermine confidence in the outcome test the outcome determinative test?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that the case law, and there are a couple of Wisconsin cases that probably highlight the difference, draw a distinction between the two.
You're talking about Avery and...
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's the same term of art, and I think that's where the confusion stems from, reasonable probability of a different outcome. And that's why the state's plain language of the statute argument doesn't work here. I mean, yes, the statute uses the word outcome, and it uses the word conviction and sentence, but so does... Strickland, for example, or Sanchez, for example, they use the term outcome, but they define it to mean was the proceeding reliable? Is our confidence in this proceeding undermined? So I think that's where the confusion stems from. And because the plain language doesn't exactly answer the question, the court can look at, use other interpretive tools. And one of them could be legislative history. But the problem we have with legislative history in this case is that there's nothing in the drafting records to show that the legislature understood the term reasonably probable to be either outcome determinative or undermine confidence. And then that's where we move on to O'Brien. And I guess I would argue to the court that ultimately it doesn't matter how you read O'Brien. I mean, it would be nice if the court looked at O'Brien and said, it's undermined confidence, same standard under the statute. But the fact of the matter is, the legislature, O'Brien was in existence, and the legislature made a decision to essentially take care of this area of law and say, okay, DNA evidence is really important, and now we're going to enact a statute that addresses DNA evidence. And so if you're just looking at the statute that way, the question for the court is, how are we going to classify DNA evidence when it comes in post-conviction? You could think of it in terms of newly discovered evidence after trial, or you might think of it as evidence that was in the hands of the prosecutor that is exculpatory and that was not turned over. Well, I think the statute answers that question because the statute under sub 2 sub A says you don't even bring this motion unless it is in the hands of the state. So we've got that. And secondly, the sub 7 A and B, the mandatory and discretionary provisions, say we are assuming that this evidence is exculpatory. Now we have exculpatory evidence in the hands of the state. It sounds an awful lot like Brady and Begley, which is the undermined confidence test, and what it asks is for the trial court to say, if this evidence had been there in the original trial, would does that undermine the reliability of that trial? Does it call the result into doubt, the hearing and everything into doubt?
Same standard for both the A1 and B2?
Well, I
same standard
undermine
as the reasonable
confidence, yes.
probability.
Mm-hmm.
Same
yes.
standard,
yes.
okay. What about our standard of review?
As we argued in the briefs, under the mandatory testing provision, we believe that the standard of review there is de novo. And under the discretionary provision, by virtue of the fact that the legislature chose to insert the word may, and it would appear to be a discretionary standard of review.
Counselor, does it make any difference that your client pled to one of the charges?
No, it doesn't.
You don't think that that has any effect on its connection to the same charges that occurred out of the same incident?
Well, he's not contesting that, first of all.
He may not be, but it may matter to what we look at in regard to our analysis of sub A2 and B1.
Well, among other things, Your Honor, he would be part of the confidence that was undermined here was the lack of a self-defense instruction as to Corey and also the length of his sentence. So that should have nothing to do with whether or not he pled to recklessly injuring Corey.
Right.
I mean, they should be treated separately.
Corey was never the aggressor, even according to him. It was always Jake, correct? She tried to break up
right.
the fight, if
well,
I understand
what you said.
Well,
she was hitting him and slapping him out in the hall.
But that was an attempt to try to break up the fight between him and Jake, or am I misunderstanding?
I think the fight occurred inside the apartment, so the whole thing begins outside, and so I'm not sure that she's hitting. I'm not sure. That'd be the best answer.
He doesn't have to claim innocence.
No, he doesn't. Well, under mandatory,
he does.
Under mandatory, but not under discretionary.
Not under discretionary, and even if he pled guilty, he could now claim innocence.
Sure.
And the standard under discretionary is, the standard of review is?
Discretionary.
Erroneous exercise.
Erroneous exercise of discretion.
Exercise.
Yes.
Okay.
Counsel, you indicated that little was there in the legislative history to shed light, or at least I heard you say, to shed light on how you define reasonably probable. Your opposing counsel in his brief cites some legislative history, the original draft of the Assembly bill, indicating that it started out as a relevancy test, but ultimately the legislation opted for a far stricter standard and adopted the recommendation of the National Conference on the Future of DNA Evidence with regard to obtaining post-conviction DNA testing. How do you respond to his read of the legislative history?
Well, Your Honor, I believe the state's brief said that the legislative history supported an outcome determinative versus an undermined confidence test, and that's incorrect. See, at the time that these statutes were being developed, there were two different ways of imposing the legal standard, and there was a materially relevant standard, which is what Illinois was advocating, and then there was a reasonable probability of a different outcome type standard, which is what the uniform statute had adopted. All the letter from Norman Gahn and the indicated there was that we want the reasonable probability language. Relevancy isn't enough. We want to have reasonable probability, but it doesn't define what that means. Is that undermine confidence, or is that outcome determinative? That's the part where the Wisconsin legislature didn't make its preference known.
Now let me comment that subsequent to that discussion to which Justice Bradley made reference, there is discussion of a proposed uniform act on post-conviction remedies by the National Commission on DNA, the future of DNA evidence. And in the interests of full disclosure to counsel, I was chair of that commission. I was very careful not to vote on any policy decisions or that particular provision that came out of that commission. And therefore, I am sitting. But if either counsel has any question about that, please feel free to write to me and the court about that, and I'm happy to reconsider. But that was my decision as of today.
Okay.
Ms. Ball, I have one additional question. Assume for purposes of this question that we accept your argument that we're looking at a test of undermining the confidence in the outcome of the verdict. You still have a total of 12 stab wounds, including two to the back of Corey. What can you point us to that would indicate that under these facts, our confidence in the outcome of the verdict would be undermined if we were to provide DNA testing?
It goes back to the self-defense theory, Your Honor, and the length of the sentence. If the evidence comes in, Jake and Corey were lying about the circumstances of the attack, and that should call everything into doubt for you. That's the long and short of it.
So the motion, if you got the evidence, and if the evidence showed that his version may be more likely than originally thought, it might be not a motion for a new trial, but a motion for change of the sentence, because the judge may have relied on evidence that is now suspect.
Is that your position? That is a possibility, yes, Your Honor.
Because under the statute, a court is given several alternatives of what to do if DNA evidence is discovered and then is brought forth.
That's correct. And I guess I'd like to point out a third option, if I may. My time is under 97407 sub 6, there is a DA disclosure provision, and that provision says, and you don't have to take my word for it, it's in the Hudson Court of Appeals decision at paragraph 12, if a person asks the state of Wisconsin to release evidence so that that person can perform independent testing, the state must do so. And in this case, my client asked for release of the evidence. You can go back and look at the original motion called a motion for release of blood samples and all of the subsequent pleadings. At the very least, in this case, no matter what else, the court should acknowledge the fact that my client asked for release of all of this and that he should have the ability to arrange for independent testing of it if he would like.
Thank you, Attorney Ball. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Call on Assistant Attorney General Daniel J. O'Brien, who has appeared before this court numerous times. And this is a first for you, too, to appear in Fond du Lac, at least before us.
That's correct. And I'm glad
to be
here.
Good seeing you here, too.
Good to be here. Thank you. May it please the court, 2 points I'd like to make at the outset. Number one, this case is not before the court, I believe, under sub A of 97407. It is only before the court under the discretionary provision, 97407 sub B.
Why do you say that?
Why do I say that? Because Mr. Moran is not claiming actual innocence, which is the only way he can get relief under the mandatory provision of sub A. Mr. Moran is claiming no innocence at all with respect to the woman he stabbed 9 times. He, in fact, pled guilty to reckless injury. He also pled guilty to an auto theft in connection with this incident. And with respect to Jake Jensen, Mr. Moran, my understanding is, cannot claim actual innocence. He can only claim that he is guilty of a less serious felony because he unreasonably exercised the right of self-defense. And therefore, he is guilty only of second-degree intentional homicide provocation under, I believe that's 940.05. That is my... There's no way, in light of the facts of this case, that Mr. Moran would be found innocent of stabbing these people. And so we are under the discretionary provision, sub B. And under that provision, you must affirm Judge Flanagan's 3 separate orders in this case, because he progressively reviewed in great detail not only the allegations in Mr. Moran's very vague and rambling pro se pleadings, but also the trial transcript, which included Mr. Moran's vague, rambling, confused testimony and pro se arguments, laying out a theory that to this day I still don't get. Another point.
Let me just go back to the innocence for a moment. Is the state's position that you the man has to be innocent of all crimes and all lesser included crimes?
Under sub A, I believe that's correct.
That's right, not innocent of just the crime convicted. That's the state's position today?
I believe that's an actual innocence standard. And to back
of all crimes included within... Related to the facts. That's even broader than I stated. So the state's position is you have to be innocent of all crimes related to the facts, not just innocent of the convicted crime.
I believe that's under sub A again, the mandatory
yes,
provision.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm.
The language of sub A suggests to me otherwise. The language of sub A says the movement claims that he or she is innocent of the offense at issue. Isn't that narrower than what you're mm-hmm. suggesting? Let me read the whole thing just to make sure that I put that on the record. The movement claims that he or she is innocent of the offense at issue in the motion under sub 2. But what I left out I don't think is...
Okay, important. And you're under sub 7A, right?
7A, yeah. So this is... So it seems to me narrower than you're suggesting if, as I would hear, the words of the offense at issue.
Of the offense at issue in the motion. But the offense at issue here was attempted murder. And he's claiming he's actually innocent. Now,
I heard your response to be that it included other crimes and all this sort of stuff, and that's what I'm thinking you
And if we're going to talk about terms of arts and case law, the actual innocence standard is something that really is actually, it's not just innocence of the charge, it's actual innocence. I am actually innocent. I am to be exonerated.
Mm-hmm.
Should not have been charged, prosecuted, or convicted.
That's not the focus of my question. The focus of my question is the focus of 7A. And it seems to me that the focus of 7A is for the specific offense at issue. Do you agree with that or disagree?
I disagree because I think that's covered by 7B. If you're saying I'm guilty of something less than what I was charged with, then then 7B kicks in. I think 7A is reserved for the classic DNA case, the Avery situation, where you have a claim of mistaken identity from beginning to end of the case, and you have new evidence that comes to light that may prove actual innocence if it's tested.
Mr. O'Brien, to follow up on Justice Bradley's question, if we were to read the statute in that fashion, wouldn't we be rendering half of that subsection as being surplusage?
Well, I don't think, because I think that's, I think that's debatable.
You'd have to read out the words of the offense at issue in the motion. You'd have to eliminate those words.
Well, I suppose you could add, would it make any difference if it just said of the offense or of the charged offense? See, I don't know how you would, I believe that this deals just with a pure exoneration, a mistaken identity situation. I don't know that the phrase at issue really changes that. I think that, if anything, it's ambiguous. I don't know that it, with or without that language, that necessarily changes the outcome. I think the existence of 7B, to me, proves the narrowness of 7A. And I think the legislative history backs that up. Norm Gahn's letter clearly says that the more stringent standard, I believe the intention was to provide DNA testing for those cases in which actual innocence is at issue. And then the comments to the uniform standard, which is worded very much like the Wisconsin statute, talks about actual innocence and the reasonable probability test, which, by the way, is based not on the Supreme Court's jurisprudence but on the New York statute. Reasonable probability test, which is an outcome determinative statute. But
now, if I can ask you about that, Mr. O'Brien, because you also seem to agree with Ms. Ball that outcome determinative is something different than the undermining confidence in the verdict. Am I correct in that?
Yeah.
But the way it's used in Bagley Isn't that the definition of the outcome determinative test?
You know, it's close, and you're really wrestling with it. It's a difficult concept. All I can say in response to that is if you show a reasonable probability of a different outcome, then you've undermined confidence in that outcome. But the reverse is not necessarily true. You could have a situation where something unfair happened at the trial, and that undermines confidence in the outcome, although there may not be a reasonable probability of a different outcome. And the best examples are the two that are referred to in those cases, the Brady situation where the state fails to disclose exculpatory evidence, or the Strickland situation where defense counsel failed to provide the defendant's Sixth Amendment right to effective representation. Because of that, even though you may have a lot of evidence against the accused, if the violation, the constitutional violation, was such that it creates doubt about the confidence in that confidence in that trial, then you may get a new trial. And the important distinction there is that you have a specific constitutional violation in the Brady context, a due process violation for non-disclosure of exculpatory evidence. Another example is the state's knowing use of perjured testimony. And then in the Strickland example, the failure to provide effective defense representation. All of those types of errors are constitutional in nature, and they very likely will undermine confidence in the fairness of that proceeding, but not necessarily create doubt about the probability of a different outcome.
Then what's the result? It undermines confidence, doesn't have a change in outcome in these constitutional violations. What's the result?
Well, it doesn't. Change of outcome is still relevant to that. I mean, I think that you still look to see
because you don't get automatic reversal in a Brady situation. You do or don't.
You do not. So you don't get automatic reversal in a Strickland case. So you're still. That's why they're so close. You're still looking at the outcomes.
Yeah, and if I could, Mr. O'Brien, here's what I see as the problem in the state's argument. If we were to accept that in order to get DNA testing at all, the result would have to be different. If we accept that that's the proposition, now we send the tests out and the DNA comes back and supports the defendant's position. Are we now required, as a matter of law, to reverse the conviction without more?
It depends on the facts of the case. I mean, if you have
But you understand the point.
No, because
you're saying that you don't even get the test unless the result would be different. Now you do the test, and the test supports the defendant's position. So the result is now different. It seems it's got to be less than that.
Well, I think it's comparable to a newly discovered evidence claim, a general newly discovered evidence claim, where you have new evidence and you're arguing that it creates a reasonable probability of a different outcome. You still have to show that. And now, I think in this situation, the judge could order a new trial. For instance, if we have the classic identity situation, mistaken identity, the judge could at that point order a new trial without taking additional evidence. Or if it's not that classic case, if it's a case like this, the judge could say, okay, fine, we've got these favorable results. I'm still not sure that it creates a reasonable probability of a different outcome. I want to take further evidence. I want to make sure what testing procedures were used, whether there's additional samples that need to be tested, you know, those sorts of issues. So I can see the problem that you're raising in the classic case, but I think in general there still needs to be more in most cases to be done.
Let me rephrase Justice Butler's question as I understand it, and it's this. Is the reasonable probability test the same on a discovery motion as it would be on a motion for a new trial? The test. Now, your response to him was that you might need more evidence or want more evidence on the motion for a new trial. The question he asked, as I understood it, is the standard the same? The reasonable probability standard the same? Because if they're the same, he says, well, you've made a decision on the motion for a new trial, in effect, instantly because you assume that the evidence is going to come back favorable to the defendant in order to rule on the discovery motion. Then it comes back favorable to the defendant. Now there's a motion for a new trial. How can you reach a different result? That's the import of the question, as I understand
it. And I think it's close. I mean, as in the newly discovered evidence situation, if you in fact prove at a hearing that your new evidence creates a reasonable probability of a different result, then the judge orders a new trial. So,
don't you have inconsistent decisions if you don't automatically do it?
But first of all, the judge has discretion on whether to order the testing in the first place. The judge may order testing in cases where he's not certain there's a reasonable probability, but does not want to risk reversal or whatnot and orders a test. I think the judge should have discretion to choose different remedies. The judge may decide at that point if the test comes back favorable in light of the facts of this case. I do find as I found to get through the motion stage to order testing, I do in fact now find, based on those test results, that there is a reasonable probability of a different outcome, and I'm going to order a new trial. But I think the judge should still be allowed some discretion because there has not been any hearing up to this point, depending on the case again, depending on the nature of the defense, the nature of the strength of the exculpatory nature of the evidence and that sort of thing, that the judge should have some discretion to decide different remedies. Maybe the judge may still want to take some more evidence before reversing. The judge may want, I don't know, a second test, something along those lines. But I believe the statute does allow for some leeway in that situation where the test comes back favorable and the judge has a number of steps that they can order, including immediate reversal, but steps short of that as well.
Mr. O'Brien, Justice Bradley has a question.
Mm-hmm. You referred to the classic case, and of course I think of, at least in recent years, the classic case has been focused on the Avery experience with the Avery Commission, the Avery case, and that case dealing with newly discovered evidence, and you have then the request for a new trial the reasonable probability of a different outcome. I think of that classic case. There they had the evidence, but here we're at discovery. You know, we want to try to get the evidence. The classic case is eyewitness identification, by the time trial arrives, the testimony is, I'm certain. The victim is certain of the identity of the defendant, or I'm almost certain, or I'm quite certain, or virtually certain, or absolutely certain. And then you have the defendant saying, I didn't do it. So that's the classic case. How can the defendant ever meet the reason they're asking for the testing is to get scientific evidence other than just having ID witness testimony by the victim. How can the classic defendant ever meet the test to get discovery? How can they show that the outcome would be different when the only real testimony at trial is, he did it, no, I didn't?
Because the language of 7A, and we're under 7A in that situation, in the classic case, unlike 7B, by the way, the language in 7A assumes the evidence will come back exculpatory, that it will come back and show that he was not, that it is not his semen, his blood, whatnot. It makes that assumption, and in that case, it should make that assumption because the defense has been consistent all along from day one. I didn't do it. They're wrong. I have an alibi. The jury didn't believe it, but if that evidence comes back exculpatory, then there is a fortiori, a reasonable probability of a different outcome. And in response to Justice Butler's question, that's the case where the judge is most likely to look at that evidence and say, all right, we're going to have a new trial.
Well, you said this case is a 7B case.
Yes.
That's your argument. So, okay, let's deal with the 7B case. Let's say this is a 7B case, not a 7A case, but take everything else that I said. In the classic 7B case,
How can the defendant ever show a reasonable probability that the outcome would be different when it's just a he said, she said case?
Well, the defendant in that situation would, well, you look at other evidence that was introduced at trial. You
if
look
it's a
at,
he said, oh, she classic, said case.
Well, but then, but now we're outside of the realm of identity. So,
no, let me be clear then. I must not be making myself clear. What I mean by he said...
See, the classic case doesn't apply in 7B.
When I say he said, she said, I mean the eyewitness identified the defendant and he did it, and the defendant says, no, I didn't. So
then you're in 7A. You're not in 7B.
Counselor, if you look at the language that's in A2 that follows reasonably probable, it talks about it is reasonably probable that the movement would not have been prosecuted. Okay, that's one mm-hmm. of the things that you look at, convicted mm-hmm. or found not guilty, and goes on. If you look at the same test that's in B1, it said it is reasonably probable that the outcome of the proceedings that resulted in the conviction essentially would have been different. The legislature used very different languages in A2 from B1. Do you attach any import to that difference in language?
Well, I think it's because B1 is broader. I mean, it does deal with a situation involving lesser included offenses or sentencing issues,
mm-hmm.
And it doesn't just deal with actual innocence. And so, so the outcome subsumes not just the trial but the sentencing proceeding, or guilty plea or something along those lines. And so, I still feel I haven't answered your question, but I really think it's important to draw the distinction that the classic case of he said, she said, you did it, no, I didn't, I have an alibi, is the 7A situation. 7B would not be invoked because that defendant doesn't want to risk being subject to the trial court's discretion to have his claim rejected when the trial court would have to mandatorily order a test if he claims actual innocence, and under 7A, and so that you know, as a practical matter, those claims are always going to be under 7A.
I want to just sum up or talk about the state's position, because this kind of passing in the night here, as I understand that A is mandatory, this is not that type of case. The trial judge, Flanagan, has to look at what took place in this case, and the state's argument is basically, if I understand it, that Moran isn't even entitled to perhaps a self-defense because he never showed that he exhausted every reasonable means to escape or otherwise avoid death or great bodily harm. I mean, that's right out of your mm-hmm. out of the red brief.
Mm-hmm.
And the position here is, and that's what the judge is saying, basically, what difference does it make, because to exercise his right of self-defense, even if there's a different version, because what concerns me is if the court opens up B to everybody exercising their right of, well, I would have been charged a little bit differently if my version had been accepted rather than somebody else's version. And Flanagan seems to be saying, well, A, the evidence is overwhelming, the stabber, and you have the stabber and the stabbee, and that Moran never exhibited, and I brought this up with opposing counsel, any other than there was some bruising, and I want to get the facts correct here, but he also went to the La Crosse police, and he made no mention of trying to stab these people in self-defense.
Yeah.
So that's what the judge, talking about Flanagan, had in front of him.
That's correct, and I share your concern about 7B, and that's why the legislature, in its wisdom, made it a discretionary provision, that the judge can do exactly what Judge Flanagan did here, which is to review the nature of the claim, the adequacy of the pleading, and to consider the evidence as presented at trial to see whether it's reasonable, whether it, on its face, creates a reasonable probability of a different outcome.
Mr. O'Brien, let me just interrupt and shift the focus for a minute. just before Attorney Ball sat down, she started talking about 974.07 paren 6, which basically, as I read it, has to do with a demand to turn over the materials for the defendant to do his or her own testing. Was that requested of Judge Flanagan, and did he turn that request down?
I'll invite you to go back and read his pro se pleadings and see if you can figure it out, because I never saw that. And there, and Judge Flanagan never addressed it. It was never raised in the Court of Appeals, and now it's being raised for the first time at oral argument. So to be honest with you, I'm not prepared to discuss sub 6 at all.
So you haven't heard this argument
no,
before?
No, this never came up before. And off the top of my head, I would say I would assume that sub 6 is subservient to sub 2A and sub 7A, which requires an adequacy of a pleading for relief before you can just go in and demand to see evidence. Now,
doesn't say that.
Well, I mean, it just seems to me that the state has an interest in preventing a defendant from destroying an entire sample with a testing that may or may not be needed. And, again, I'm not prepared to argue that, because that's an argument that's never been raised below at any point, and or even in the briefs in this court. So our focus should be on, is he entitled to relief under 7A or B? And
would you agree, Mr. O'Brien, that a person who's alleging self-defense could come under either 7A or B?
I think there could be a situation.
You just don't think
it's not
this
case, but I think you're right. I think there are cases where you could have a pure self-defense case where he's completely innocent, depending on the facts. I'd hate to try to imagine the facts, but we've seen those cases. I think we know that this is not one of those. This is a case where, it's interesting. In order for Mr. Moran to prevail here, you have to believe that both Jake Jensen and Corey Pinchard committed perjury. Why they would commit perjury, I don't know. They committed perjury, even though there are a bunch of undisputed facts here, like 12 stab wounds, like the fact that Mr. Moran came over uninvited, snuck up the back stairs at 1 a.m., drunk, carrying a knife, and like the fact that these people went to confront him, went down the stairs to lock the door to keep him out, but unfortunately he was already there. And so they're lying about some things, but not the most important things. What motive would they have to lie about this? I don't know. If there was a brawl in the hallway or in the apartment, why would they admit that? See, for him to prevail, Corey Pinchard is a liar. This woman who was stabbed 9 times just made this all up. And the fact is, when she testified that he chased her through the apartment and stabbed her in the kitchen and again in the bedroom, that's all made up, except there's a problem there, because her blood was the one sample that came back positive, and that was in the kitchen. So that validates her testimony. If her testimony stands, then his testimony about his wrestling with Jake falls apart too, his story. Because if Jake's in that apartment and he hasn't been stabbed yet, why is he watching his girlfriend get stabbed 9 times when he's got a brick there? And if he's already been stabbed, and we're not clear because his testimony doesn't tell us, but if Jake's already been stabbed, yes, he suffered some serious injuries, but he's still ambulatory. He can still pick up that brick and go after him. That's the gaping hole in this whole thing that Judge Flanagan saw. And then, you're right, Mr. Moran feels that he can exercise the right to use deadly force in self-defense, and he was uninjured. He claims that he got hit in the head either with a brick or with a door or something, but his own testimony, and I'd ask you to go back and review it, it's difficult to read, but in his testimony, he adamantly admits that he was only bruised. So he suffered bruises, and in response, he inflicts 12 stab wounds on 2 people. So when we're talking about reasonable probabilities here, this is precisely the sort of situation where a trial judge should have great discretion in not allowing this to proceed any further and in saying, I don't see it. You haven't presented a coherent theory here.
Your point is that even if the DNA testing is done and it comes back and it supports the defendant's position, it doesn't matter under these facts because he simply used too much force.
That's correct. And Judge Flanagan made that express finding. If you, especially his August 21st order, as supplemented by, I think it's his February 2003 order, he said, even assuming that's the case, it doesn't change things because it's such a preposterous theory. It doesn't stand up. And the fact that he confessed the next day and never mentioned self-defense, and the fact that the La Crosse police saw no injuries on him, the fact that his T-shirt was recovered without any blood on it. So, you know, I think that's the sort of factual, discretionary sort of determination that a trial judge can make.
And if I could pin you down, it's your position that you prevail even under the undermining the confidence in the outcome.
Yes, because I don't think there's. I think you can have full confidence in this outcome, and you might say, well, but what if Jake's blood is in that apartment when Jake said he got stabbed outside the apartment? This was a bloody scene. People were going in and out of that apartment. There was a knife use. There was blood splattering. It's conceivable that blood got on someone else and they went into that apartment, or an investigating officer stepped on something. So that doesn't necessarily show anything. It certainly doesn't show anything with respect to Corey, and it shows very little with respect to Jake, other than Jake might have, yes, he might have been lying, but it's also very possible that he might have been confused. He was being stabbed. Maybe he forgot that he fell inside the doorway of the apartment. So, Judge Flanagan took all of this into account and evaluated the possibility. Again, we're talking about reasonableness here. It's not just a probability. It's a reasonable probability of a different outcome. And there's no reasonable probability of a different outcome. And under the undermines confidence, these issues were fully and fairly tried. He made these arguments at trial. The jury didn't buy it, not just because it was he said, she said, or he said, they said, because all of the other evidence defeated that any claim of self-defense, especially his own confession the next day, where he said he went up there because he was angry at them. They betrayed him. They were having sex. And he snuck up there at 1 a.m. knowing he was uninvited with a knife. And when confronted by the people who were trying to protect themselves by locking a door that they didn't succeed in getting to, he pulls that knife and attacks them. That is not self-defense. You know, once I had an argument in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals where, on a habeas case, the opposing counsel was arguing he was entitled to a self-defense instruction because he thought the man walking away from him, who he shot in the back, was going to his car to retrieve a gun. And at the end of his argument, Judge Coffey asked counsel, can you cite me, counsel, one Wisconsin case, or for that matter, any case in any other jurisdiction, that allows you to exercise the right of self-defense by shooting someone in the back as they're walking away from you? Well, Mr. Moran stabbed Corey Pinchard 9 times, twice in the back as she tried to run away from him. That is not self-defense under any stretch of the imagination.
I have 2 questions for you, Mr. O'Brien. One, does Judge Flanagan, in effect, retry the case in his own mind to determine whether it's a reasonable probability?
Again, this is a discretionary provision, so the judge can pretty much decide what he or she wants to review. And I think in this case it was wise for him to review the transcript because of the convoluted nature of the defendant's testimony, because of the length of the trial, the dispute over where people were. So in that situation, I think it is not so much retry the case, but just review the record, review the testimony, not so much to weigh, well, I mean, to again, evaluating reasonable probability for collateral post-conviction relief to attack a presumptively valid conviction.
He weighs the evidence.
But he doesn't go back and look at reasonable doubt. It's just
look at reasonable doubt. Okay.
It's the reasonable probability. Well, the jury's verdict is relevant, obviously, but he or she doesn't make himself a super juror.
That's the point of my question,
yeah.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Okay. My second question deals with the standard of review. Under A2, that's the mandatory testing, what's your position on standard of review? And let me give you the question so you see where I'm going. B1 is discretionary testing, what's the standard of review? And how does that all fit with your position that this is a pleading case under Bentley and Allen?
Yeah, and that's where I think under A, see, B, it's still discretionary. So,
right.
For instance, so, under B, even if the motion is very specific, the judge could theoretically, in the exercise of discretion, deny it because of a finding of lack of reasonable probability.
Right.
Under A.
Well, what's the standard review under B2?
Discretionary.
Okay.
Erroneous exercise.
Okay.
Right.
What's the state's position on A1?
On one, our position is that if we're at the pleading stage, we look at the adequacy of the pleading, and that would be reviewed de novo as it is under Bentley Allen. And then if the judge denied a test based on the perceived inadequacy of the pleading, and this court agrees that the pleading was facially inadequate, then this court must defer to the judge's discretionary decision not to proceed with a hearing if discretion was properly exercised on the record.
It's a two-step procedure?
That's our position on A.
I didn't understand from your briefs.
Yeah, and I know it's a little bit different than the case law, like in the newly discovered evidence in the O'Brien standard. It's straight discretionary review standard. But I think this makes more sense because, and that's really what Judge Flanagan did here. I mean, he looked at the pleading. If you look at his motion, he's repeatedly talking about the vague allegations and quoting portions of his allegations and saying, you know, I just don't see it. And so this court could review that pleading independently, but then.
Okay, so we review it, suppose, and say it's adequate. Now, the judge said it was inadequate. Mm-hmm. So what do? Reverse them?
You would then, I would. If you found it adequate, then I think you would order testing. I mean, you could
order
remand
okay.
for
now,
an order to order testing, unless there are additional factual issues that might be developed. But
the trial judge says it's inadequate, and we agree with the trial judge that it's inadequate. Mm-hmm. That's a question of law.
I believe this court has treated it as such in Bentley and Allen. You know that you're both looking at the same pleading,
right? And so all on the record.
Yeah. And does it meet the 5 W's 1 H test in Allen?
Does erroneous exercise of discretion come in at all under A1? That's what's confusing me. Sometimes I think your brief says yes. Sometimes I think it says no, and I'm not sure because it's pages 11 and
okay, it clearly would if tests were actually ordered, the judge denied a new trial, and then you would review that from erroneous exercise of discretion. But we're not there.
Right.
So here what you do is you review the pleading. Then, you know, I guess I would say this. If the judge actually makes factual findings, then you apply a not clearly erroneous standard.
To those facts. What do we do about the ultimate decision?
Well.
And I got that from your brief.
Okay.
I think that's clear.
And this might work more in the sub B case where you have a specific motion, but the judge says no reasonable probability of a more favorable outcome. In that situation, now you're talking about more or less an evidentiary standard based on the information before the judge, and that might be subject to deferential review.
But that would be the erroneous exercise. Okay.
That ultimate determination that this does not add up to a reasonable probability, especially in a case where the judge does what Flanagan did here, which is also review the testimony and is going a little bit beyond the motion in almost like a summary judgment sort of a situation here.
Belt and suspender.
I'm sorry?
A belt and suspender
decision.
Two prongs. So you kill it under both. Kill review, or at least a reversal. It's good. Good trial court practice.
Yeah.
Okay.
So hopefully I've answered that, and I know my light's been on for quite a while, so.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Ms. Ball?
Just a couple points in rebuttal.
I hope you'll start with subsection 6, which is only quoted or cited once in your reply brief and not on the proposition that Justice Crooks raised?
I would be happy to start with subsection 6. Your Honor, I do not believe the state of Wisconsin has checked the record in this case. I am going to read to you right now an excerpt from the motion for permission to release the blood samples.
Which motion, first or second?
The first motion. It comes up repeatedly, but here's the first motion.
Could you give me the record cite on that?
Yes, Your Honor.
If easily ascertainable. If not, we'll get it later.
We'll find it.
It will. Now I've got to go back to my place. The defendant would ask that these two unknown blood samples and the three blood standards that were given by the three individuals involved to be released so the defendant could have them sent to Cellmark Laboratory, the same laboratory which was performed the testing for the defense in State v. Hicks. See Exhibit A, the letter from Attorney George Limbeck to the Assistant District Attorney requesting the release of these samples. Now, he did it in the original motion. And just a minute, I may very well have the record cite right here. He did it. I guess I'd really like the court to understand what happened here.
What about the second motion?
R86.
Are we here on the second motion?
I believe it's in the second motion. R86, R90, R94, and 103. And you need to understand how all these things come together. My client, a pro se litigant, makes a motion for release of blood samples. He doesn't cite 97407, and he doesn't cite O'Brien either.
That's the first motion.
Yes. The state doesn't respond to my client's motion. The state files a separate motion to deny my client's request for discovery under O'Brien. That's how O'Brien got into this case. It didn't want to respond to the motion for release of the blood samples. And so my client responds to that motion, and he raises, I believe in the second one as well, the thought that, look, all I really want you to do is release it, and I'll take care of the testing. Now, this case went up on appeal, and I would invite this court to look at my client's pro se appellate brief again. He says, look, I just want the evidence so I can do the testing. And he says in it a couple of times, well, I had money, my parents were going to pay for it, and now my parents don't have any money anymore. So this subject came up repeatedly, and the reason that the case was postured the way it was when it got here is that the state said, oh, wait, you have to meet the O'Brien test. And then the court says, I deny it under O'Brien. And then my client, a pro se litigant, says, well, wait a second, 97407 is in effect. See, the state of Wisconsin's arguing O'Brien after 97407 was adopted and in effect for about 9 or 10 months. That's why we have such a confusing procedural posture. And I just want to urge you, on behalf of my client, I believe that he meets the reasonable probability standard. I'm going to return to that in a second. But at a bare minimum, we should acknowledge, hey, state, just release the evidence. We won't impose any burden on you. Just release it. And if it proves what my client wants, fine. He has to come back in court and request some sort of relief based upon it.
Well, just now, you go ahead.
Just release it subject to any motion or condition that the court would
yes,
put upon
of
the
course,
release,
of
as
course.
Set forth in the statute.
Of course.
Well, I'm looking at his Court of Appeals brief, and on page 12, he says, the defendant moved the circuit court to release blood samples that are in the possession of the government. And that it's being maintained in the defendant's case, thereby meeting the standard of 97407-2B. And then he recites 2C. Is that the kind of thing you're relying on?
I think it is in there elsewhere as well. Okay. But yes, Your Honor. Unfortunately, I don't have his Court of Appeals brief with me right now. Mm-hmm. The second point that I wanted to address is why we really can slice through the evidence here, despite whatever the testimony came in regarding the wounds, the confession, etc. All we're asking the court here is to not second-guess the prosecutor. At the moment the state of Wisconsin decided to put on the serologist, the detective, to put on all the blood evidence at trial, it knew every piece of evidence that Attorney O'Brien just highlighted for a court. It knew it all, and yet it still considered these three witnesses' testimony significant enough. It considered the blood evidence important enough, the source of it, to go back to that apartment and get it. And the reason is because it tested James Moran's self-defense theory. It tested his credibility and the credibility of the two complaining witnesses. So Mr. Moran would ask the court to grant one of two forms of relief, either order the testing and release of the samples so that he can test the additional evidence outside Corey's door, or, at a minimum, just order the state to release the evidence. Thank you very much.
Are they still willing to pay for it?
Your Honor, I don't know if his parents still have the means to pay for it. I was appointed to represent him pro bono, and I understand that he is an indigent client. So I don't know the answer to that question.
Thank you, Ms. Ball. That closes the hearing on 03-0561-CR State versus James M. Moran. On behalf of the court, we want to thank attorneys Colleen Ball and Daniel J. O'Brien for their usual good job in our first case that deals with the new statute relating to DNA evidence. So thank you, and it's good seeing you both in Madison and again here in Fond du Lac. Thank you. The court will be